Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sandeep Roy, editor of New America Media and host of Upfront on KALW-FM. Tonight's program has been generously underwritten by Coret Foundation Funds. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Paul Rusesabagina, activist and author of An Ordinary Man, about his experiences in Rwanda during that country's genocide. Even if Don Cheadle had not immortalized him on screen in his Oscar-nominated role in Hotel Rwanda, Paul Rusesabagina's place in history would be secure. He was one of the few bright points of light during the Rwanda genocide of 1994, sheltering over 1,200 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in a hotel for 76 harrowing days, while thousands were butchered all around them, and the rest of the world bickered over whether to call it genocide or acts of genocide. He's been called the Oscar Schindler of Rwanda, but he says he was just an ordinary man doing what he was trained to do as a hotel manager, give shelter to those who needed it. In fact, his memoir is called An Ordinary Man. Please welcome Paul Rusesabagina.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good. I can see that there. Tonight, I do not have a lot of time. I just have 25 to 30 minutes. But during those few minutes, I'll just tell you, I could tell you my life as an ordinary person, an ordinary man, starting from the time when I was born in the night of June the 15th, 1954, up to date. But I have decided only to jump a few dates, a few events in my life, and only talk about a few experiences I had in the Mikkelin Hotel during the Rwandan genocide. And I'll start by questions. Many times, even this morning, I met journalists. In the afternoon as well, I met them. But one of the most questions that almost all of them asked me was, why did you decide to risk your life and protect other people's lives? I always say that I have never taken a decision myself to risk my life in order to help others. Someone else somewhere decided for me. I believe God decided for me. Why? Because already on day one, stuck of the genocide, stuck in my house, I had 26 neighbors who came to stay in my house. Why did they decide to gather in my house instead of going to someone else's house? That much I have never understood. If there's anyone who would like to ask me that question, I won't answer because I never had an answer, the right one. We stayed together, those people and myself, and my family, my whole family, stuck for 3 days. On day three of the genocide, I was standing with one of my guests, those neighbors who had gathered in my house. We were standing in my living. And then when we were standing, we happened to see soldiers climbing the gate, getting in. Knowing purposely what had been going on all around us, my neighbor started shaking, telling me that, listen, Paul, these guys are looking for me. They know that I have three sons who are fighting for the rebels. They want to kill me. Before they come in, please, let me deliver myself so that they can kill me and you people will be safe. I looked at him and told him that, my friend, whoever comes to my house is not looking for you. These people are looking for me. Let me go and meet them. I opened my door and went to meet them. In such circumstances, it was not like a joke. But sometimes, when you meet such people, you do have to start somewhere. And I had to start from somewhere. I had to start by opening up a window of dialogue, telling them that, listen, my friends, didn't you ring? If you had not rung, now I could have come and opened for you. Why did you climb? Why did you have to climb? A young captain who was leading the team came to me and told me that, sir, are you the manager of the Diplomat Hotel? At that time, I had left the Mikolin Hotel 1.5 years before. I was a manager in a sister hotel, in the Diplomat Hotel. Then I told him that, sir, I am the manager. If you are the manager, a new government has been put up because the other one had been beheaded. The president was killed. His general chief of staff was killed. Some cabinet ministers were killed with him. His medical doctor, his military advisor, and many others had been killed in the same airplane. Then a new government had been put up. And when they were put up, they decided to take over my hotel. And taking over my hotel, they arrived in the hotel, and before I left, I do not know who advised me to do this. But on the 6th, I took all the rooms' keys for the rooms which were not occupied that night and kept them in my office. I took the seller's keys to my office. I took the store's keys to my office. And then I took my car and went home. So when they arrived, they had no supplies. And when they had no supplies, they had to look for me because they needed me. I told him that, sir, you have a very good mission. Excellent. But I cannot leave behind my family. And in the family, initially, we were 6 people. 4 children, my wife and myself. But that day, we were 32 people. They were so cool, so calm, so kind. They told me that, sir, take everyone. I said, wow, what good guys. And when I said good guys, within myself, I did not know who they were. We drove, and a mile away, not on the hotel compound, as Hotel Rwanda puts in, but just on a street of Kigali, just a mile away from my house, I saw the jeep which was ahead of us, slowing down, stopping, and then all of those guys and me also stopped, and the jeep which was ahead of behind us and my neighbor, we, all of us, stopped. All of those soldiers, who a few minutes before were so kind, so cool, jumped out of their jeeps, each and everyone pointing his gun to my head. I remember that young captain telling me that, you, traitor, you are lucky. We are not killing you today. But have this gun. Kill all of you cockroaches in these cars. I knew he was not joking because all along the street, there were so many dead bodies, some of them missing their heads, others' bellies opened, mutilated. We could see what was going on. It was very clear. I knew he was not joking. I can assure you, that time, I stayed speechless for 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, I then opened my mouth. And again, opened up that kind of window. The window of dialogue, and starting talking, telling him that, sir, myself, I do not know how to use guns. But even if I knew, I do not see any good reason why I should kill these people. I should kill this old man, that old man who was in my car. There was a young lady who was holding her second baby. I just pointed down that baby and told him that, my friend, are you sure that in me we are fighting today, you and I, is this baby? Many times, when we deal with such people, we have to touch their sensitive side. The ego is always very important. I told them that, my friends, you guys, I do understand you. You are tired. You are stressed by this war. You are hungry, thirsty. I do understand you. But we can find other solutions. Then, and only then, we started finding other solutions. We started talking. And after 2 long hours of discussions, we found a solution. The solution was to escort us up to the hotel and me go to the hotel safe, give them, pay them the money I had promised. That day, I was scared and very much scared, but I had learned a very important lesson. I had crossed eyes with the devil, and I had learned how to deal with evil. I stayed there for another three days. And on the 11th, at 5 p.m. in the evening, the real Mikolin manager this time, was evacuated. And when he was evacuated, before leaving the hotel, he phoned me and told me that, listen, Paul, I'm leaving. Can you please sometimes have a look at the Mikolin Hotel? I told him that, sir, I will, but please, I might not be able because I'm with the government. The following day in the morning, on the 12th, this was day 6 of the genocide, the same government, very early in the morning, started packing everything, taking everything into their cars, including hotel properties, blankets, bed sheets. When I saw them taking everything, I said to myself that these guys are leaving. I then went upstairs, told my wife and my children that, listen, you guys, these people are leaving. Since they are leaving, let us join their convoy and we leave. I joined their convoy, for sure. And after joining their convoy, we drove a mile away from the Diplomat Hotel is the Mikolin. Mikolin is located at a distance of a mile from the Diplomat. Then we turned left, went in the Mikolin Hotel, and this is the place where we're going to stay for the next 70 days. Life, when I arrived, was so complicated. There was no security all around the hotel. And there was no manager. There was militiamen had just set up a roadblock at the main entrance of the hotel. I had 2 challenges. One was to get the roadblock removed. The second one, to get protection for the hotel. I took what I describe in An Ordinary Man, this book that you have seen. I took my black binder and started where I had all the phone numbers, all the addresses. I had been writing them down. And then I started calling all the generals I knew in the country. And at the end of the day, I had 5 gendarmes, 5 policemen, for instance, who came to protect the hotel and who stayed until the end. This was just the beginning, and the roadblock also, of course, was removed. Life became so difficult that even our water was cut off. And when the water was cut off, without any alternative, we started drinking the swimming pool water. People started coming down, bringing their dustbins from their hotel rooms, to fetch a few drops of water and take it to their rooms for the day. In the evening, people were coming back again, taking another few drops of water and using it for the night. Electricity went off. When electricity was off, I put on generators. In a few days, a generator can never work 24 hours a day. It broke down. And then we started cooking with firewood, smuggling kind of the firewood. I will never forget in my life that kind of life without water, without electricity, and also without food. Our food was limited at a given time to corn and dry beans. Twice a day, people were just eating that and nothing else than that. Life became so difficult that even the hotel was being attacked almost every day. For those who has seen Hotel Rwanda, you saw what happened on April 23rd. On April 23rd, I had gone to sleep at a very late hour. I had gone to sleep at 4. I had spent my time phoning, just sending faxes whenever I could, still sitting down and drafting a note and sending it, disturbing each and everyone in the international community, calling the United States, the White House, the Peace Corps, the United Nations, Paris, calling Brussels, disturbing each and everyone I could. And I went to sleep at 4 a.m. When I went to sleep, I was woken up at 6 by soldiers from the Ministry of Defense with, this time, an order to turn out all the Mikorin refugees. And I was given just 30 minutes to do that. I jumped out of my bed, again dealing. But I started by charming, telling them that, listen, my friends, all of these people who are here are refugees. If I tell them to leave, I'll be telling them that they are going where? Who's taking them? How is he taking them? They just looked at me and said, did you really understand our message? Did we really decode this message? I said, maybe no. Maybe I didn't understand what you meant to say. Tell those cockroaches to live as they came. Dehumanizing human beings. Dehumanizing people before killing them. So that killing them is rather removing an infestation. I said, now, your message is decoded. But please, give me rather 30 minutes. So that I can get ready and then do what you want. After a long discussion again, I was given my 30 minutes. And when I was given 30 minutes, I looked all around me and all around the hotel. There were many militia men, soldiers, military uniforms, with the guns, with all the traditional weapons that each and everyone might think of. That day, for the first time in my life, I was desperate. I was desperate. I just said to myself that morning that, listen, Paul, this is the end. But it was never the end. I just started, but their timing was perfect, of course, because 6 a.m. in Kigali was also 6 a.m. in Brussels and Paris, which was midnight in Washington, D.C. and New York. So the timing was perfect. The international community was not supposed even to know what was supposed to happen. I then took again my black binder, as defined in an ordinary man, and started now calling again all the generals I knew in the country. Before the end of my 30 minutes, I saw the assistant general chief of the police on the hotel compound. And when I saw him, I said to myself that now everything is going okay because he's not the one who is going to kill us. That day, this gentleman saved our lives. But 3 days later, one of my guests who were there, a journalist called Kamilindi Thomas, took a hotel phone. Started to describe how rebels were advancing, how the militiamen and the army were losing, and yet we were on the army side. When he started describing that on Radio France International, before the end of his interview, I saw one of the men who was in charge of security in the whole city just coming from the hotel main entrance, saying, just telling me loudly, that, "Listen, Paul, I have come to pick up that dog." I invited him to my office. We sat down. I just started convincing him, telling him that, "Sir, this is not a colonel's duty to hunt after a dog. This is a very dirty job, which is supposed to be done by small boys. This is not your job." After a long discussion, he left the hotel without Thomas. Today, Thomas lives in Michigan, since he also had no other choice than fleeing the country, going to exile in 2005. He was persecuted many times, put in prison many times for his work, for being a journalist, and then he ended up going to exile. Last year, I was invited by Ann Arbor, the university, to be given an award, the Raoul Wallenberg Award. And I was very much touched to notice that when I was going to speak, the person I saw on the podium introducing me, I was backstage. I hadn't met him. I never knew that he was there. Was Thomas Kamilindi, who introduced me in tears. Today he lives in America. But even if the colonel left without him, immediately our phones were broken down, were just completely cut off. And you can imagine, you are a soldier, you are fighting. And a soldier on a war without a weapon is no more a soldier. The uniform does not help. It rather betrays. Our weapon was broken down. And when our weapon was broken down, we decided, I was running up and down, picking up each and every phone, trying each and every one to see which one was might be working. And I was desperate. When I was desperate, just moving there, in the secretary's office, I happened to pick up the fax phone. It was working. I said to myself that always God has got means and ways to save his own people. That day, God also saved us, because that line remained working. And from that day onwards, I had no choice than hiding that line and using it as a few people who were just concerned by organizing the refugees and myself. Life became so difficult, without any hope to survive. The hotel being attacked every now and then, without any chance to leave that place. Until, if I go towards the end, June the 17th. On June the 17th, very early in the morning, I learned that militiamen were killing civil refugees in a neighboring church, the St. Famille Church, which is about 500 meters away from the hotel, and you can just within 5 minutes walk. You could see from the even now, from the hotel rooms, you can see what is going on the compound of the church. When I learned that militiamen were killing those people, I felt very much concerned and started again phoning, calling for help. I was almost 24 hours a day disturbing the people. I started calling, phoning, asking for help. And when I was phoning, I saw the mayor of Kigali outside there, just coming in the hotel. I ran to meet him. And when I met him, when I started telling him that, sir, you are the right man I'm looking for. You are the right person. You are the key, the solution to my problem. I need soldiers. I want to reinforce security all around this hotel. And you have the solution. I need soldiers. He looked at me and told me that, listen, Paul, I don't have soldiers. All the soldiers are fighting. Others are protecting government building, official buildings. Government buildings. Very bitter and very angry. I looked at him and told him that, sir, all of this you and I see today will one day come to an end. And that day of the end, whatever happens, we will have to face history. Imagine. Think if that day was today and you and I facing history, are you sure that the answer you are giving me right now is the answer you would give to history? I was offending him. I was aggressive. He looked at me for a few seconds, turned his back, and joined his bodyguards. I saw him getting into his car and disappearing. That day, I stayed again standing without any solution in my mind, looking for other solutions, but without any. But I remembered that I had an appointment with his boss, General Bizimungu, and went to meet him at the Diplomat Hotel. When I was standing in the Diplomat Hotel with him, I was informed that after killing 150 people in the St. Fermi Church, those militiamen came running to the Mikolin Hotel and started breaking doors. When I just told him, the general, let us go down to the Mikolin Hotel and do something. Immediately, General Bizimungu and myself, we went down to the Mikolin Hotel. And when we arrived, I remember General Bizimungu himself telling all the refugees, all the militiamen who were in the hotel, that you guys, whoever we kill someone, I'm killing him. Whoever we beat someone, I'm killing him. Whoever will remain in this house for the next 5 minutes, I will kill him. He went up and down himself, removed all of those guys. And yet, many Mikolin refugees had been gathered down surrounding the swimming pool, some of them kneeling down, hands up, some praying, ready for their death. That day, in the afternoon, a few UN soldiers who had remained in Rwanda, because the UN was there, and when the genocide started on day one, immediately the United Nations decided to pull out, to withdraw, to abandon a whole nation to thugs and thieves and gangsters and street boys and killers. Those ones with the army and the rebels had been sitting down to find ways and means of evacuating all the refugees. And that day, immediately after we were saved by General Bizimungu, the UN, again, those people met and made a decision. And the decision this time was to evacuate all the Mikolin refugees and without a condition. They came to me in the evening, past 5, and told me that, listen, we want to evacuate all of these people. I said that, listen, my friends, let us learn from history. Last time, we tried to do this, but we couldn't. We couldn't succeed. It was not a success. Because these people, it was too late. Because of the darkness, these people were killed almost, escaped just by luck. And today, why don't we reinforce rather security around the hotel and evacuate all of these people tomorrow? They listened to me. We reinforced security that day and the following day. All the Mikolin refugees were evacuated to destinations of their own choices. From the beginning to the end, the Mikolin Hotel had 1,268 refugees. None of them had been killed. None of them had been beaten. None of them had been taken out to be killed or tortured outside. Thank God. God had performed a miracle. But was it the same throughout the whole country? I doubt very much. It was not the same. We also were evacuated to the rebel side. When we arrived, Men were being invited for meetings, killed. Their sons recruited in the rebels' army, killed. As some people who were just around the 40s and above were invited now to train for another training, which is called local defense, a new kind of militia. Myself, I had said, I'm sorry, I do not use guns. But those ones, a few of those ones who went, including my hotel employee, were killed and never came back. But in Rwanda, sometimes we say that all of those people who have been invited for meetings are still attending meetings. All of those who were recruited are still training. One day, they might come back. I did not go to Tanzania, as Hotel Rwanda suggests, but I rather came back to town and started cleaning both hotels, Mikolin and Diplomat. But in the meantime, I just, with my wife and a friend, we drove down south to see what was remaining in our families. All along the way, the whole country was smelling death, and many dead bodies were more or less fresh. In the whole country, all along the roads, you couldn't see anything, any human being alive. There was no animal moving. And yet, in Rwanda, what you see all along the roads are children, kids, and sometimes young men moving, just moving. What for? You never know why they are there. But at that time, the whole country was empty. We could hear dogs barking from far. We drove up to my hometown, which is closer. When we arrived, by luck, my elder brother was there. When he saw me, he just blamed me, saying, "But what are you doing here? Please." I started asking him questions. Where were our neighbors? Where were our brothers and sisters? Our elder sister had been killed by the rebels. Our younger brother had been killed by the rebels. Many other people had been killed by militia men. Others by soldiers. At a given time, my brother, when I was asking him and him showing me houses burning, our cousins and their wives and children burning in, he told me that, "Please leave this place. Because even these curtains you see have got eyes and ears. They see you, they do listen to you." I decoded his message. We went down south to see, further south, to see my mother-in-law. When we arrived, she had been killed with her daughter-in-law, 6 grandchildren, and all of them thrown in a pit where we use to mature bananas in order to make banana juices and banana beers. That was a journey, the longest of my life. That day, I sat down in the ruins, and just like a young boy, like a young baby, all of us, we cried. We drove back to Kigali, and where we stayed for more than 2 years again, before also a time when I was almost killed, escaped by luck. When I escaped, I had no alternative than fleeing the country, going to exile. Had we learned a lesson as Rwandans? No. Had the world learned a lesson? No. Because 2 years ago, I went to Darfur to witness with my own eyes, see what was going on in Darfur. But what did I see? What I had been seeing in Rwanda. In Rwanda, 1991, 1992, 1993, 1994, around the beginning of 1994, a few days before the genocide, we had more than 1 million people surrounding Kigali, coming to beg in town, going to sleep in the open air, under the sun, under the rain, without food, without shelter, without education for their children. For 4 years, those people had been living that kind of life. Since 1959, Rwandans have been on the road going to exile. Many others had fled the country in 1959, 1973. It has become a habit. And then that time also, it was the first Hutu exodus was starting before continuing crossing the border, going to borders, going to Tanzania, Burundi, and the Congo, and so on. Then that was, this is exactly what I saw in the fore. Many children without schools, when they saw us, they demonstrated peacefully with a big blackboard on which they had written, "Welcome to our guests." Had we learned a lesson so far? Thank you. Think about it.
Thanks to Paul Rusesabagina. We've got a lot of questions here. So I'm going to start without further ado. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Paul Rusesabagina, who's discussing his experiences sheltering hundreds of fellow Rwandans during the genocide. I'm going to start with a couple of questions that deal with the 76 days. I know in your book you talk about how you were training initially before you became a hotel manager to be a pastor and to go into the church. How important was prayer in helping you and your guests cope through those harrowing days?
In such circumstances, people always come close to God. Even those ones who in normal circumstances do never pray, that time they try to be closer to God. But when, as we were praying, I remember we had learned some prayers. And when we're praying, after praying, we're saying, "But God, where have you gone?" We used to be, as Rwandans, very proud that God wanders the world and makes sure to come to sleep in Rwanda. But that time, we were always asking him, "Where are you?"
Why did you change the numbers on the hotel rooms? People saw that scene in the movie.
Many people who were in the Mikkelin Hotel were very well-known people because Mikkelin had the elite intellectuals, the elite businessmen in the country, the elite politicians, including all the prime ministers who have been in Rwanda since 1995. Rwigema Pierre Celestin was in the Mikkelin Hotel. Makuza also, who is today the prime minister, was also in the Mikkelin Hotel. And many ministers, many other high-ranking politicians, opposition leaders were there. And militiamen who were coming and going out knew almost all of those guys. So removing the numbers was in a way confusing the people, the killers, so that they do not know that so-and-so is in such a room and the other one is in such a room. That is why I removed those numbers from the doors.
Still on the movie, there's a scene where the character based on you visits the leader of the militia, and he tells you to take a back road back to the hotel, and it is covered with dead bodies. Is this based on something that really happened?
No, that is based on... this is a composite character made by filmmakers to show what was happening in the hotel, and also outside the door, the windows or the walls of the hotel, what was going on. If you have watched Hotel Rwanda, you saw the manager going out just twice. Once is that time. That was to give the audience the image of what was going on outside. And then the second time, which is a real one, is when I was also evacuating. At the end, I went with the last, behind the last convoy. So when I was evacuating, that is when I also went out. So the filmmakers wanted to put the audience in a mood of thinking beyond the walls, what was happening outside the sanctuary, what was happening.
Well, you are in the land of Hollywood, so I'll get all the movie questions out here. And this is the one I think is on everyone's mind. What do you think of Don Cheadle's performance of you, and did he meet with you before the movie to get it right?
That is a very interesting question. Don Cheadle is a very good guy. And if I start from the conclusion, after playing Hotel Rwanda, he became a humanitarian. And we went together to Darfur. But Don Cheadle, before playing me, he never knew the kind of person I am. He never knew who I am. We could talk on the phone for 2 hours and more, but without him perceiving me the way I was not. He had taken me as someone who maybe had been hiding in alcohol, who had lost his senses, who do not remember what is north, what is south, who does not had anything in mind. Until a time we met, before he played me, we had to meet, stay together for a week in Johannesburg, South Africa. This was December 2003. We stayed together, going out together, having a drink each and every evening, a glass of wine sometimes, to put him in the ambience of a hotel manager. and then him very much worried because playing the role of someone who is there, who will come and watch you, even when you'll be performing, it is not very simple. I was very open to him, and also he wanted to get the maximum out of myself so that he can play the right person.
Is the hotel itself still around? Is it still in service?
Yes. Miquelin Hotel and Diplomat, both hotels were safe from the beginning to the end, both belonging to the Sabena Airline Company. Both are still there. The Diplomat has been extended. It is now Intercontinental Hotel, but Miquelin remains Miquelin. The owner, Sabena, went bankrupt, but Miquelin was sold to another owner who is a Rwandan.
Moving on to some of sort of the more global implications, what do Westerners misunderstand the most about the Rwandan genocide?
The Westerners have not yet understood us. What we say in Belgium, we say that each and every Belgian has got his own Rwandan, and each and every Rwandan has got his own Belgian. Because the Westerners who sympathize Hutus become more Hutus than Hutus themselves. The ones who sympathize Tutsis become more Tutsis than Tutsis themselves. So the Western countries have never taken the right middle, sat down with us, with the both of us, and tell us, now you guys, you know each other, talk.
How much of the strife in Rwanda is due to the legacy of colonialism versus the struggle for resources?
Well, actually, Rwanda did not have a lot of resources. But since it was next, Rwanda and Burundi were next to the giant Congo, of course, there's a legacy of colonialism. A part of the divide and rule, divide and conquer politics, which was practiced by colonizers, separating Rwandans who were already separated, taking Tutsis to be more intelligent and made to be leaders, and Hutus made to respect the rules and regulations from Tutsis and colonizers, that separated us. In 1933, when our first IDs were being made, they went even as far, just to put a difference between the two, as far as measuring noses. So you can imagine how far that went. Saying that a Tutsi nose is supposed to be longer than a Hutu nose by so many inches. Saying that a Tutsi is supposed to be elegant and a Hutu is not supposed to be elegant. Saying that someone who has got, for instance, 10 cows, this is an example I give, is supposed to be a Tutsi because a Hutu cannot have 10 cows. So you can imagine the colonization also did a lot of harm to the Rwandan community.
Do you blame the international community for what happened?
Of course I do. But before blaming the international community, I blame ourselves, because we are also responsible to what happened to us. But the international community also, I blame them. Why? Because these people, they saw, we were all of us seeing what was going to happen. The situation was so tense, so nervous. When the president of Burundi was killed on October 22nd, killed by the army, the Burundis, the Tutsi army, the whole world was seeing the hatred between both ethnic groups in both countries. When then the UN that time was organizing to send us peacekeepers, because there was a war in Rwanda between Hutus and Tutsis, Tutsi rebels attacking from Uganda. And then when during the war, a peace agreement had been signed. And when a peace agreement has been signed, this international community we are talking about sent us 2,500 soldiers, UN, so to speak, peacekeepers. But on day one of the genocide, when 10 Belgian soldiers were killed with the prime minister they were protecting, immediately, the Belgian cabinet meeting met, and then they decided to pull out from the peacekeepers. And when they decided, backed by the United States, the United Kingdom, the whole world decided to pull out. And yet, we had placed our hope in the international community. Many people who had fled the capital city, Kigali, because most of the people had fled the capital city, it was no more safe. Other people were just staying in neighboring towns, coming to work in Kigali, going to sleep outside, out there, and making sure to leave Kigali before the sunset. You can imagine how the situation was. And that time, to make it worse, then killing both presidents of Rwanda and Burundi was just like pouring oil on a burning fire. The whole situation was clear, and the international community pulled out. The 2,500 soldiers they had, that is how many people who had trusted the international community had gathered in schools, in churches, under the UN protection. But the UN just turned backs, closed eyes and ears, and abandoned those people who, most of them, were killed.
I'm going to move to a few questions that are sort of about the aftermath and the situation now. What is your perspective on the community court system in Rwanda, especially with regard to its effectiveness in seeking justice for the families of the victims of the genocide?
I think that the best solution for Rwanda is not Gacaca. Why not Gacaca? Because first of all, Gacaca is a biased institution controlled by the government, dictated by the government. Secondly, Gacaca is supposed to try only the people who participated in the genocide only. And yet, there are many other people who participated in other crimes against humanity who are still free, more free than the wind. There are people who committed war crimes who are also free. In 1994, after the 100 days, we saw many people being tied from the back, being thrown in containers, dying there. They being burnt, their ashes thrown in the forest. We saw many politicians being killed, assassinated, while getting into their compound in the evening. We saw government helicopters destroying camps, a camp within the country in Kibeho between April the 17th, April 1995, April 17th, between 17th and the 20th, for 4 days. And on the ground, soldiers, the government soldiers, with machine guns, killing each and everyone. That was the aftermath. Those guys who killed Whoever killed, whoever sheds blood should face justice. And Gachacha is only for that. If you read the resolution, the UN resolution, putting up the International Criminal Court for Rwanda, Resolution 955 of November 8th, 1994, it states clearly that all war criminals between January 1st, 1994 and December 31st, all war criminals, all criminals of the genocide, all criminals of the criminals against humanity are supposed to be treated. They are supposed to be convicted. This is their duty and their obligation. And yet, there is no step still trying to convict war criminals and criminals against humanity. So, now if you want to reconcile, you have two sons, this one has made a mistake, the other one has made another mistake, you need to reconcile those guys. As a parent, as the United Nations, an institution like that one, or our friends, the most important thing is to call both and get them around the table. Each and everyone who made a mistake is supposed to pay for it. And this is it.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Paul Rusesabagina, who's discussing his experiences sheltering hundreds of fellow Rwandans during the genocide, as detailed in his memoir, An Ordinary Man. I have a question here that says, why right now have you spoken about the possibility of this happening again, perhaps in reverse, and whether that is not a divisive message to put out?
This is what I say. I first of all compare Rwanda before 1994. Before 1994, in Rwanda, we had the war starting, first of all, which never ended. Because even today, there are Rwandans who are still in the Congo. So Rwanda is like a volcano which can erupt any time. Then, that time, we had also a war before the genocide. We had an army. Today, we also have an army. We had a police, which was even not very strong. Today, we have a police. We had a militia, and today we have one. The local defense people who are armed by the government, given weapons and munitions. Those people are not paid. Each and every 20 houses or so are controlled by one person. That time also, it was more or less the same. The militiamen were controlling almost all the hills and mountains. Each and everyone was controlled. People were intimidated. Today, people are intimidated. So what is the difference between the period before 1994 in what is going on today? To me, there's none. Humanitarians were threatened. Some of them killed. Today, it is all the same. Journalists were fleeing the country. Today, journalists, I told you about Kamilindi Thomas, who was in the Mikolin Hotel. Today, he's also a refugee, among many others. So, what is the difference?
The current president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, spoke at the Commonwealth Club about his personal story of fighting the genocide in the 90s, but you're not a great admirer of him. Why?
Well, I'm not supposed to. And he is neither my admirer.
Another person that you referred to, and you actually mentioned him in the speech that you gave about General Bizumingu.
Yes.
Some of the opposition claim he's on trial, accused of genocide and crimes against humanity, but want to know, is this true, and what is your view on this?
Well, General Bizumingu, I'm not defending him as the General Chief of Staff in the Rwandan Army. I know purposely that General Bizimungu is responsible. He has been leading people, even if he himself never took a gun and killed anyone. But being a general chief of staff for an army killing civilians, that in itself is already a good cause for him to face justice. But what I say is this, is the fact that General Bizimungu helped the hotel. And this is my right to say it. Saying that someone who is being tried, who is on trial, is not supposed to have done anything good, I think that this is not true. He did something good, but he was also leading an army accused of killing civilians. Then he's got to face justice. Kagame also was leading an army. That army has also killed innocent civilians. I wouldn't be surprised to see him also facing trials.
Do you have in Rwanda a monument or other places that commemorate the victims of the genocide?
Myself or?
No, is there? Does they exist in Rwanda?
Oh, yes. What kind there are many genocide sites, genocide memorials, not only one. For those who have seen Hotel Rwanda, you also was in Murambi, Gikongoro, where we had gone to visit one of those memorials. They are there, and there are many. It is not one.
Do you believe that heroic values and actions like the ones you portrayed during the crisis, can values like that be taught?
Be taught?
Could you have a school?
Well,
like hotel management.
In life, this is a very complicated question, but in my life, I believe that there are values that we learn in all the schools of the world, but there are other things that we never learn in any school or around the world. There are values which are within ourselves, and those ones, unfortunately, we won't get them anywhere.
You know, you spoke about blaming both people in Rwanda as well as the international community, but do you have any understanding at all, now that you live in the West as well, of the response of the international community, why it acted the way it did, and what do you have to say to them?
To the international community, immediately after the genocide, 1994, 95, and so on, I was a very bitter man. I was very angry against each and everyone, because no one, when people were dying, when we were just being killed, no one intervened. And since no one intervened, I was bitter against each and everyone. But I realized that keeping quiet, keeping away from others, I was rather torturing myself. And I realized that also, if you want to score goals, have you played soccer?
A little bit.
Yeah. If you want to score goals, you've got to go to the field. If you are not on the field, you never score. So the best way is just to get in and play. Then you'll score.
How would you advise us as Americans to act, score, or speak regarding the genocide going on in Sudan right now?
What I would suggest is a lot of things. Don Chiddle and myself, first of all, we are the first people who, for the first time, when we were promoting Hotel Rwanda, spoke out and said, "Save Darfur." What can Americans do in saving Darfur? Americans can raise awareness, tell each and everyone, but not only in words. Sign petitions. Give them to your senators. Send them to the administration, to the president himself, and ask him to tell the Sudanese government that those guys are not untouchable. They are human beings like anyone else. They can one day face justice. Why don't we tell them that? Secondly, why don't we ask those people to freeze their wealth, all of their assets, the money, all of those dictators in Africa, especially, whenever they become president, in 3 months, each and everyone is a millionaire. In a year, each and everyone is a billionaire. Where do they get that money? They steal from they ask for loans for their own countries. And after asking for loans, they start bringing back that money. We say that money given to Africans comes in a plane, moves all over the capital cities, and does never land. It just comes back to land in Washington, D.C., where it came from, or Paris, or Brussels, Amsterdam, and Switzerland. So why don't we ask our leaders to freeze those assets, since all of them are in the West, and above all, the people, for those ones who are not very young, you saw what happened late 80s, early 90s, when people went down to the streets, demonstrating in Europe and America against apartheid. What is apartheid? We do no more talk about it. Apartheid is more or less gone. So why don't we go down to the streets and demonstrate what those dictators are doing? Another good lesson. About 7 years ago, a man named Milosevic in the former Yugoslavia had been killing people, committing a genocide. The NATO sent soldiers. They got hold of him, brought him to Den Haag. Why don't we bring those guys to Den Haag? This would be a better solution.
You currently live in Belgium, so there's two questions in one. What's your current life like, and what are your plans for the future? Do you have, for example, political ambitions in Rwanda?
Well, political ambitions, not yet. But to have political ambitions, I believe, is the right of each and every citizen who thinks that he can be useful to his own nation. But in my life today, I'm a humanitarian. What do I do in life? I have a trucking business based in Lusaka, Zambia, and I'm surviving on my trucking business. I move around many times, raising awareness, as I have done tonight, and I did yesterday, and I have been doing. I have a foundation, the Hotel Rwanda Rusesabagina Foundation, which is helping. And my aim is to make it wider, more international.
And how are you received in Rwanda itself? When were you last there?
Well, it depends on when. I do not know how I can be received today. But when I went there after 7 years in exile, in 2003, I went back with the filmmakers who wanted to make sure that the story they were going to bring to the big screen was a true story. We flew together and stayed in Rwanda for 15 days. How was the welcome? That day, when we landed in Kigali, it was at 7, almost at this time, at 7:30 p.m. And Mikolin survivors were already from the plane to the tarmac, were there to welcome me. I went up to the airport lobby. There were many people, more than 100 people, who had come to welcome me, and everyone wanted to hug me in tears. Filmmakers couldn't understand what was going on. They invited us with a film crew. We went to one of those people, medical doctors. We went to their home. They had prepared a very big, heavy feast for the night. We stayed there. Filmmakers left that place at 2 a.m. the following morning and went to sleep in the Mikolin Hotel. But me, I stayed with my friends, of course. When did we close? I can tell you.
We're out of time, but I wanted to give you 30 seconds to ask, if you got to go back to the Mikolin tomorrow or in the near future, what would you want to do there?
Whenever I go to the Mikkelin Hotel since 1994, I always go to the swimming pool bar. I sit down there, sip my coffee, watching that water of life that saved lives, a thousand and more lives during that period of time.
Thanks to Paul Rusesabagina, activist, author of An Ordinary Man.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Tonight's program has generously been underwritten by the Coret Foundation Funds. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Sandeep Roy. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.